Good morning or good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our Q2 results conference call. I'm here with David Cole, our Group CFO, as well as Philippe Brahin, our Head of Investor Relations. Let me start with a brief overview of the results we published this morning. As you have seen, we reported solid results, even though the quarter was impacted by large losses and persisting challenging market conditions. Q2 2016 group net income was $637 million, bringing us to a total net income of $1.9 billion and an ROE of 10.9% for the first half. P&C Reinsurance reports an ROE of 9.4% this quarter, impacted by a series of large losses, such as wildfires in Canada, earthquakes in Japan, and floods in Europe. In the July renewals, we continued reducing capacity to our flow business and growing our portfolio of large and tailored transactions. These transactions are placed with us on a private basis and offer differentiated economics. In this context, we managed to maintain our risk-adjusted price quality at 102% year to date. Lifelines Reinsurance maintains its solid performance with an ROE of 10.1%. Corporate Solutions results are impacted by two large 2015-related casualty losses, and the business unit reports a negative ROE of 4.2%. Because Corporate Solutions currently mainly operates in the excess layer business, it is exposed to a relatively high degree of volatility. Life Capital delivers another quarter of strong performance with an ROE of 13.4%, once again benefiting from net realized gains from the derivative portfolio of Guardian. We continue to reduce the exposure of this portfolio to this volatility during the quarter. Finally, our asset management team produced a strong ROI of 3.7% despite the low interest rate environment. Overall, our invested asset base increased, driven by the Guardian acquisition. All business units have now paid dividends to the group, and the capital position of the group remains very strong. With that, I'll hand over to our Head of Investor Relations, Philippe Brahin, who will introduce the Q&A session.
Many thanks, Christian, and good day also to all of you from my side. Just before we turn to the Q&A, I would like to remind you to please restrict yourself to two questions each and re-register for follow-up questions. With that, operator, could we please take the first question?
Sure. The first question is from Xinmei Wang, Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Hi. Two questions, please. My first question is on the losses in the pricing environment. Given that we've seen quite unusual large losses in this quarter, I was wondering how unusual do you think the losses are? Would you say that given these, that there's an opportunity now to deploy capital in this market from that? My second question is on the combined ratio guidance for 2016 in P&C Re. Do you think the 99% underlying guidance is still achievable given the results? I think Matt also mentioned on the 1Q conference call that we should be expecting more growth in casualty and maybe some more pricing impacts to come through. Thank you.
Okay, I'll take the first one. In terms of the nat cat losses Q2, I think overall the sum was $351 million. The biggest chunk of it comes from Canada. That is higher than expected for Q2, but I have to put it in context, right? In Q1, we had no nat cat losses. Together, actually, Q1 plus Q2, the overall cat losses are slightly below our expected. Taking that into account, I doubt that this in itself will lead to higher prices in the next renewal round. I think what will eventually move prices, apart from a potential large loss, is a whole series of other factors, pressures coming from all different angles, one of which being obviously the low interest rate environment, which hurts people. One could be on the reserving side if reserve releases start to be less abundant. Yes, if loss ratios overall just approach the average expected loss and you take some of the other factors, we could get into a situation that even in the absence of a very large loss, prices start to stabilize again and maybe go slightly up. I would say Q2 in itself is really nothing particular in terms of the cat loss.
Let me come back to the second question. Thanks for that. Indeed, I recall the discussion with Matt at the time of our Q1 results. You recall at Q1, we had an adjusted combined ratio for P&C Re of a little bit below 96 at 95.7. Now with Q2, we're reporting 101.9. So for the first half, 98.8, which is just slightly underneath the guidance that we've given for the entire year of 99. There's nothing at this point that would lead us to conclude that we should adjust that. I think what Matt was talking about is just the inherent uncertainty of these estimates, if you will, given the uncertain exact mix of our business, what happens with pricing over the various subsequent periods. So there's nothing now in our Q2 results or developments off the back of the July renewals that would suggest to us that the 99% guidance is still not the appropriate figure.
Our next question is from Olivia Brindle, Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Please go ahead.
Hi there. My first two questions. The first one, just thinking about your updated combined ratio methodology, where when you talked about that at 1Q, you mentioned this $300 million of cat losses, which effectively comes through as prior year development the following year. So I was wondering if you could update us on how much of this is in the year-to-date numbers, so effectively relating to 2015. How do we think about that $300 million? And then secondly, on the reserving position and thinking about your buffers for the longer tail lines of business, I was just trying to quickly look through the triangles that you published and compare them to where we were previously. So it sort of looks like on your general liability lines, you're slightly healthier, but the motor is maybe slightly weaker. I was just wondering if that seems like a fair assessment, and in particular in light of some of the reserve additions you've made on the motor side year to date, has that sort of restored your buffers to previous levels? That would be helpful to hear. Thank you.
Thank you. So let me actually start with the second. I'll come back to the first. So thanks for mentioning the reserve book that we also publish, as you know, every year at this time. A couple of general comments. So we haven't changed our reserving philosophy. We continue to be prudently reserved, best estimate across the entire book, which we go through the process of four times a year. There always are individual adjustments on various lines across the different geographies. But overall, I would say we've maintained our comfort in terms of where we are within the best estimate range. You know, we tend to be north of 50, actually, generally positioned somewhere between 60 and 80, and that continues to be the case. There are always individual lines a little bit above that and lines a little bit below that, but overall I think we continue to feel that we have a very appropriate, prudent level of reserves, and nothing has changed now related to developments in Q2 that alters that position. As to the adjusted combined ratio, actually, I'm going to say, Olivia, no, not a whole lot more I'm going to give you on that. We published our numbers for Q1 and for Q2. We're going to come back, of course, at least on an annual basis and give you folks some updates on that. But I think sometimes there's a little bit of a move toward overly defined, overly spurious type of granularity and accuracy in some of these things. So we're going to keep with the numbers that we've produced. There's nothing that's changed. We still have the overall expected loss budget of $1.5 billion, the recognition that not all of it comes through in the form of actual claims during the course of the year, that some part of it will hold over from previous years. So no update there.
If I could just follow up on the reserving side for motor quickly. Are you comfortable now, having made, I guess, two quarters of additions on the U.S. side, that that's reflective of market conditions, or should we expect anything further there?
No, absolutely. I mean, of course, I don't know what will happen going forward, but based on all the information that we know, the information we receive from our cedents, we've gone through our portfolios. We topped them up, as you mentioned, earlier this year, second time now in Q2. But we believe that the level of reserving that we have for that business is also there prudent.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Our next question is from Kamran Hossain, RBC Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Hi, afternoon, everyone. I've got two questions. One for Christian. I guess 4 weeks into the job as CEO, can you just maybe run through what are the biggest concerns, that you're looking to address at Swiss Re in the coming year? So kind of what are the things that are, you know, on your desk, you know, top priority? And the second question, I guess this one for David, in terms of the realisation of gains, obviously second quarter saw quite a bit of that again. In Life Capital specifically, will these continue throughout the year, or are you pretty much done now? Thanks very much.
Yep, thanks.
Thanks, Cameron, for a tricky question. Very smart way to asking. So anyway, to me, there's obviously no big surprises because I've been part of the executive committee for 10 years now. So my life hasn't completely changed in these last 4 weeks, nor have I discovered anything I didn't know before. So it's very much everything in a continuous mood. What is very clear and obvious is that we're in a cycle, we enter a period that is more difficult, right? The whole industry enters that, and it has started a while ago. And I think all the new CEOs in Europe, in particular, in the insurance industry, will face some of that. One obvious one is the low interest rate environment, which now, after this quarter, is probably going to stay even longer low, which particularly impacts life and health, primary life and health, so some of our clients, but also some of us, right? Because the investment side is really important. So that must be a concern of every CEO in the insurance industry. And the other one is the obvious pricing cycle in P&C, which is nothing new, has always happened. And we certainly keep very calm, but we know it's concerning and it's not pleasant when you're on the way down. So we see some slowing down of that, but it's not yet the bottom, it seems. And so I'm mentally prepared for one or two difficult years before the cycle inevitably turns, because I still believe in cycles. Obviously, I see nothing that would prevent cycles to continue in the future. So I have no big news for you. I think it's pretty simple. You have the asset side and you have the liability side. And on the liability side, it's the P&C Corso area, which is a higher concern. Other than that, I have nothing particular on my mind.
I'm sure we'll hear more in December.
Thanks. Let me pick up the second question, and thanks for that. Let me be very short. There's no way that we would expect the level of profits that Life Capital has delivered in the first half would be repeated in the second half. As you know, we acquired Guardian. We're in the process and, in fact, have by and large done what we wanted to do, and bring that portfolio under our governance, positioning it also for Solvency II. Moving a little bit out of the derivatives market, more into the cash market. Also looking at the underlying investments and determining that they meet our quality expectations as well. So we've been transitioning that investment portfolio over the course of the last 6 months. And we've frankly benefited. Sometimes it's good to be lucky. We frankly benefited from, during that period of time, interest rates have been reducing while we were still sitting on that derivatives portfolio. But that is now, as I mentioned, by and large done. There still may be a little bit of trimming and managing the portfolio that we would expect to do subsequent to the Part 7 transfer, which, as you know, we anticipate during the course of 2017. Offsetting the P&L benefit that we've seen, it has had a little bit of a drag on the level of cash generation that we report as a result of the same lower interest rates driving a higher solvency requirement under Solvency II. We experienced the impact of that a little bit more significantly in Q1 than in Q2. Actually, very happy to see that the underlying business is very much performing in line with our expectations. The integration of Guardian is very much going in line with our expectation. And also on that basis, we've reconfirmed our target of 1.4 to 1.7 billion of cash coming off of that business during the period 2016-2018.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Sure.
The next question is from William Hawkins, KBW. Please go ahead.
Hello. Thank you very much. Can you tell us what lessons you're learning from these two losses you've taken in the Corporate Solutions division? I'm not sure I understand the facts completely, but on the one hand, they seem to be two completely discrete loss events, but there seems to be a great coincidence in location, size, timing, and nature of loss. So is there something on the underwriting side that you need to have learned from that? What's going on with those losses? And then very briefly on a point of detail, did you get your exposure there as a follower in a syndicate, or were you the leaders of that exposure you took on? And then secondly, a capital management question. This looks like we're heading towards the first year in about 4 years when you're going to have a normal P&C result. If that happens, it looks like your P&C re-earnings are going to be at least $1 billion lower than they've been for the past few years, which may imply that the dividends from P&C to the centre could be lower than for the past few years, which then makes it look like the buyback coverage into the future carries significantly greater risk. you've never kind of committed medium term on that point, but you know, how concerned should we be about the sustainability of the buyback if you do end up getting a few more normal years of P&C results? Thank you.
So I can take the first one, even though CORSO is obviously not yet my speciality, but I'm working a lot to get into it. So as you can imagine, we studied that in quite some detail, right, these two losses. And I think there's really, I can't see any commonality between the two, except that maybe they're in California and you have a tort system there that gives very generous rewards to claimants. But I would say, taking a step back, right, if you think about the whole strategy of corporate solutions, to me, it still makes complete sense to have that strategy, as we're a risk knowledge company and it gives us access to risk we wouldn't have otherwise. I think the philosophy of it is also quite clear. That is, we write risks to the balance sheet, to the full balance sheet of Swiss Re. So we don't try to optimize this little subpart of the business, which means they don't buy tons of reinsurance to isolate themselves from returns. As a result of that, I would expect a higher overall return on average from corporate solutions compared to some peers, but also some higher volatility where sometimes they have larger losses. And the team hasn't changed over the years. And if I look at their track record, I think they definitely completely fulfill that expectation. So the general performance has been higher than average in the industry. But this quarter, and we don't see our competitors yet, but this quarter have been hit by two losses, which is disappointing, but has to be expected. I think another fact plays a role, which is that the book isn't that large yet. So that adds, I guess, to the volatility we have to expect from that book of business. And that's something that should take care of itself over time. I mean, this said, it's clear that in this part of the business, everywhere, the margins are going down, as they do in P&C Re. And the only right thing to do for the team is to be very careful on the underwriting side, having strong discipline. And I think there's a lot of evidence of that I could find. In particular, they have stopped growing basically now. 2015, they haven't grown. This year, they grow a bit, but that's due to acquisitions. If you take everything out, they are actually quite disciplined. So I have full trust in that business. And at this stage, I don't think we need to change anything drastically just because of these two losses.
So to summarize that, it does sound like you're thinking it's more bad luck than anything you need to address.
Yep.
Well, let me pick up the second question about capital management. And the first thing is, I just reiterate that the way that we've expressed this in the past continues to apply today. And I say that really just to underline what we hope will, over time, really be seen as a consistency. There is no commitment, indeed, to future share buybacks. Even the possibility for 2016 is subject to how our capital position will develop during the course of the year, as well as the opportunities that we would see to invest it back into the business at acceptable returns. And that's also in line with what we've said in the past. There's no doubt that if you just look back over the last several years, you're absolutely correct. We've, I think, printed some extraordinary profits off of our P&C Re business. Even the first half of this year, notwithstanding the fact that pricing has been under pressure, given the loss burden so far the first half, our ROE for the business is still a very respectable 13.7%. But in terms of forward-looking comments, let me just reiterate our approach, which is, of course, to maintain the financial strength, to maintain the regular dividend. We are able to increase the regular dividend whenever we are successful in investing into attractive opportunities in the business. That takes precedence over additional share capital repatriations. But still, when we find ourselves sitting on this excess capital that we don't really believe we'll be able to reasonably deploy within a fairly short period of time, then we look to give it back. And that takes place in the first instance, of course, through the dividend. But then as an additional tool, we have the authorization, which needs to be renewed in principle every year. We have the authorization from our shareholders. So I would caution about penciling in these things. We've said that before. There's no difference today than what I've said about that in the past. We'll continue to watch how the business develops, our capital position develops, the opportunities to invest develop. And later in the year, if we come to the conclusion that it looks like we're going to be sitting on this excess capital, then we'll come back to the market with some further communication around the buyback.
Thank you, guys.
Yep.
The next question is from Andrew Ritchie, Autonomous Research. Please go ahead.
Oh, hi there. Actually, just following up on William's question, just on capital deployment. The first question, David, year to date, you've seen very strong growth in the business, particularly bespoke through bespoke transactions. Is that still sort of diversifying growth? Because obviously it's been in casualty lines such that the economic capital, the incremental economic capital required or SST capital required hasn't been that significant. Or are we at the point where it's no longer diversifying because casualty has sort of reached 50% of the book? So maybe just comment on the capital intensity of the 18% growth year to date. And the second question linked to capital deployment. You're very confident that Guardian is going well, that's now integrated. Are we at a point now where you'd be comfortable looking for further deals in the UK? Is the business ready to do more deals? We obviously saw some press commentary about third-party capital, which I think you commented on in the press. Maybe for Christian, if you just remind us again what your attitude is to third-party capital in Admin Re and the appetite for further deals. Thanks.
So let me pick up the first one, Andrew. Yeah, and you're right. Up until now, the additional casual business that we've been writing has been more diversifying than anything else. That, of course, will not continue forever, particularly if we continue to, on the one hand, grow that that line of business while we are taking a little bit of capital off the table in the windstorm property nat cat area. But so far, it actually has been growth that hasn't really overall across the group required a lot of additional capital. Our capital position remains strong. You've seen, of course, all the dividends that come up to the group, but also on an economic basis. Obviously, we have some volatility in the marketplace, but our capital position allows us, I think, to carry that volatility quite nicely. So far, that additional business mix development hasn't really taken a whole lot of additional capital. Let me turn it over to Christian for the second.
Yes, yeah. I mean, you saw our reaction, which was basically that we wouldn't comment on the market rumors. So not surprisingly. I think this said, we said at the Investor Day last year that we would be exploring options to have other capital in that business. And I think the main reason is that it's clearly a very interesting business with potentially a lot of growth potential, in particular now in the environment you see. I think from all of our segments, that could be actually one where there's a lot of interest. You see tons of capital who'd love to enter but doesn't get access because there's a regulator here who'd be worried to give it to them. There's clients who don't want necessarily to give this to a hedge fund or a private equity group, etc. And then there's Swiss Re here in the middle, which has all the knowledge, the capabilities and everything, but potentially not all the capital to do significant transactions in the space. So it's all about this puzzle and how to solve it. And I think there could be interesting opportunities. And we're going to continue to explore these opportunities.
And Guardian is sufficiently integrated now that there wouldn't be a lot of risk in another block, is that fair?
So Guardian is on track, right? You have to think about the lead times of anything. Obviously, if we found shareholders for the existing book, that's not distracting anybody from a further acquisition. If it was about further acquisition, it is always a lead time of at least 6 months, if it's not 9 months. And then if it's a separate legal entity and you do Part 7, you can also park it for 1 or 2 years or 3 years and then do it. So I don't think we're necessarily limited in doing a transaction in view of all the timelines. But the integration is not finished. But if I think about all of these pieces, I think fundamentally we can discuss about other transactions at this stage.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Our next question is from In-Yong Wang, Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my questions. My first one's on the large transaction that you've been seeing. Just wondering, from the demand side, what is driving these deals? Are they very much client-specific issues, or do you see a common theme, such as regulatory changes, for the large deals that you've done in the last year or so? And my second question is on the life and health. There's a comment in the presentation about an adverse experience in the Americas. Just a bit more detail on what that is, because I think one of your life reinsurance competitors in the US have reported quite good US mortality trends. So, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so let me take the large transaction bit. There are various motivations, but I think a common pattern is when you have a new CEO, new CFO taking over, they look at their whole portfolio, they look at what kinds of ROE they get from all bits and pieces, they have new plans to grow in certain areas, and they like to free up capital in old areas, sometimes even if it's a loss, sometimes without generating an IFRS or GAAP loss. And then the transactions themselves can be all kinds of things. So it could be adverse development covers for P&C reserves, for example. It could be a going forward quota share that takes out business that has a high combined ratio, if that's what bothers them. It could be a NatCat protection over several years, or an aggregate under that cat programs. An aggregate meaning a program that adds up all the losses in the year, and if the sum of small losses in a year exceeds a certain amount, we pay. So it's sort of structured solutions that are very specific to the needs of a company, but generally it's for people who want to free up capital or take out volatility. It's not so much driven by Solvency II, let's say, or regulatory regimes at this stage. One exception to that is the big life and health transactions. They are sometimes driven by that.
Sure.
Let me pick up the second question about the experience on the life and health side. Listen, one quarter doesn't really say a whole lot. You made reference to some other player who's referenced some positive experience. I think if you look back over the last couple of years, more often than not, we've also had, relatively speaking, positive experience on the mortality, morbidity side. This quarter, we had a little bit less positive experience versus expectation, but there's no real trend here. The underlying business continues, I think, to perform in a way that gives us comfort regarding the through-the-cycle type of return. We had 10.1% ROE this quarter, notwithstanding a higher equity base and notwithstanding some periodic adjustments that we do just going through and looking at the valuations. And added on top of that, the quarterly negative experience versus expectation. So I don't see anything in here that suggests something other than just a random volatility.
Sure. Great. All right. Thank you.
The next question is from Vinit Malhotra, Mediobanca. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. So one on PNC and one on life, please. On PNC, we've all been looking at these NatCat pricing and noticing a lot of comments in the industry that pricing is stabilizing a bit. So I was a bit surprised to see that you're saying now that we are reducing NatCat in the US. That's on your July renewals. Could you just comment a bit about, is this, in your view, the right time to reduce the US NatCat? So that's the first question. And on the life and health, obviously, we've seen the turnaround in life and health as a segment, but just going one step lower into the segment, life and health separately, I noticed that health has shown some of the adverse effects that Inyong just discussed with you. And the health EBIT is actually a bit lower than the recent history as well in this quarter. So just if you could comment once again, you know, in 1Q, you changed the ROE target definition from, you know, the old 5.5 equity base to current equity base, but equity base has again gone up by $1 billion or so in this quarter. So in this whole context of health being a bit weakish, depending on model updates and changes, is the 10 to 12 ROE on a new current ROE still in place? Thank you.
Okay, I'll start with the NatCat while the others think how to answer the health questions. So, I mean, when people say prices are stabilizing, I think that's a nice description for further decreases. So from a mathematical point of view, I would say the second derivative is turning positive, but not the first one, which means that the decline of the decline is not happening anymore. So instead of whatever, minus 10, you now have minus 3 or minus 2 or minus 5, but it's still negative. And as you can see in our long-term price adequacy of 102%, we cannot afford much more, right? We're hitting the target of where we stop creating value for shareholders. And so I absolutely told the team already in January, but now also preparing for the renewal, if prices go down further, even if it's smaller amounts, that we should scale back on the flow business further. We have already scaled back 7%. We've scaled back some of the US NatCat, and we will scale back further if necessary. And I think that's the only right thing to do. So it's a question really of if the margin is very thin, even a small decline makes it really uneconomic, and we should be very consequential in that. On health, I don't know if...
life and health. Well, let me just first start with the second part of your question, which is about the equity base. You're absolutely right. Whenever we were, let's say, in the business doing the work that we had identified back in 2013, we said we thought that by 2015 we'd be able to generate a ROE of 10 to 12%. But we completely uncomfortable with what may happen with interest rates over that period of time, so we said let's fix the equity base at that $5.5 billion. Of course, we proceeded to implement those different actions, continue to write good business, put the right asset mix in place, dealt with some of this pre-2004 issue in the U.S., and then also finalized with putting the right capital structure in place for the segment. Now, we're a couple of years beyond that. I think 2015, we were very very pleased with the result. Also, through 2016, we have an ROE of the quarter for 10.1, but for the half of still 12.6, I think, off the top of my head. If you look more specifically, indeed, the equity base has gone up, but we said that we thought the 10 to 12% would still be an appropriate target, independent, if you will, somewhat of the equity base. I guess it's not without risk, that statement, but we think we also need to be able to give some sort of sense of comfort, confidence to our investors. The health results in Q2, actually, there were some updates on the assumptions and valuations, of course, had a negative impact in health. The actual experience for health in Q2 was positive versus our expectations. So I certainly would not see something there to indicate a trouble in terms of performance going forward. Just reiterate that 10 to 12% is a through-the-cycle target. We're not going to hit it every quarter. There will always be some volatility also in the life and health business. If you take a second to think about the absolute magnitude, the size of our in-force book as we go and on just a completely rigorous, constant basis going through our portfolios on the basis of new data, on the basis of reviews of our model, assumptions that may from time to time need to be adjusted. There's always going to be some volatility, but we feel comfortable that the book as a whole is a good quality, and the underlying performance will continue to meet our expectations.
All right, thank you.
Sure.
The next question is from Sami Taipalus, Berenberg. Please go ahead. Mr. Taipalus, your line is open.
Hello, afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, perfect. Sorry, I think I had the phone on mute, actually. Just a question on your liability business and some of the stuff that you've got in your reserve disclosures. If you look at the ultimate loss ratios in there, they tend to be in sort of mid-80s to 90s on liability reinsurance. And if you add on the expense ratio onto that, you get to probably around 120 for recent treaty years in terms of ultimate combined ratio. I just want how that sort of a combined ratio makes sense in the current interest rate environment, because again, it's a book that you've been growing quite a bit recently, and I appreciate what was said before about it being relatively capital light when you're diversifying, but it seems nevertheless like this is a pretty low level of profitability. That was the first question. Then the second big thing I wanted to ask about was the reserves and CorSo this time. Even if you strip out those two major large claims that you flag, there still seem to be a little bit of adverse PYD in Q2, and there was a bit of adverse PYD in Q1 as well, which is quite a sharp turnaround from what we were seeing last year and the year before that. Is there any trend there, or is this just sort of random volatility? Thank you.
So on the second question, there's a small little bit of PYD excluding these losses. These two specific losses are a little bit challenging in that regard because they happened in 2015. We only got real information about it this year. It shows up as a PYD, but in the general context of the way we discuss PYD, somewhat of a different animal. If I look back over the last couple of years, we've had years where it's been positive, years where it's been negative. The PYD I'm talking about, there's a little bit of a quarterly volatility around that. But if you strip out this $103 million coming off of these two losses, a meaningless figure for Q2 for Corporate Solutions. So I don't think there's really a story there. I have to say, you've puzzled me a little bit with your first question, and I don't exactly recognize some of the figures, but maybe we can take it offline to go into a little bit more detail of about a specific line or a specific year that we're referring to. But just in general, listen, we recognize that from time to time, the combined ratio on a reporting year basis can sometimes even go above 100% and it still be an attractive book of business to write. But I don't think it would be appropriate sense that you may have that somehow we're sitting on serious lines of business or reserves where we're expecting an ultimate loss somewhere in the range of 120%. I think we can follow up, if you don't mind, offline, but I don't recognize that.
Yeah. It really isn't anything complicated. If you look at the slides in your reserving presentation, yeah. I mean, I may have misread this, but where it says ultimate loss ratio, it's kind of between 85 and 90 roughly for all years except one since 2007. And your normal expense ratio is around 30 to 35%. So if you add those two together, you get to somewhere around 120. So, that seems quite a bit above 110. So I'm just wondering why.
There could be an individual year. I mean, I can pick any one of the different slides you want to. I'm happy to go through it in detail. There's some years, of course, in soft markets where you do have ultimate loss ratios in excess of 100. But if you look at the overall book across the different accident year, treaty years, you'll see, I think, a very consistent figure below the ultimate loss level of 100% on the book. So there may be individual lines, individual years that have experienced, of course, the ramifications of soft market environments. But one thing I can tell you is that consistently across our book, with the exception of recently some updates on the motor side, and of course the ongoing story around asbestos in the United States particularly, we remain, I think, very comfortable with the way the existing reserves have developed and the overall level of prudence associated with that. As I mentioned, typically we sit somewhere between 60 and 80% of the best estimate range, notwithstanding the fact that over the last couple of years, for different reasons, we've had some prior year positive development. Actually, in the overall positioning within the range, we have not gone down. So we've basically stayed flat or even in some lines of businesses moved up a little bit.
Yeah, all right, okay.
We're happy to follow up afterwards if you don't mind.
Our next question is from Thomas Fossard, HSBC. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon. One question left on my side, which will relate to the hurdle rate you've got in mind regarding any, I would say, big deals or acquisitions or ability to deploy excess capital. I've got in the back of my mind, I've got an 11% hurdle rate, which probably dates from a couple of quarters back. Is there any change in your thinking of how much is hurdle right now? Are you still looking for 11%, or has it changed in light of the new interest rate environment? Any update on that? Thank you.
A quick answer, no, it hasn't changed. Obviously, that's the kind of thing that from time to time you may have to review, but we continue to believe that for large allocations of capital, so I'm not talking about every individual transaction that we would do, but certainly for large allocations of capital, that having that type of rule of thumb, if you will, 11% ROE, it's on a U.S. GAAP basis, is not a bad thing to have. Of course, we look at transactions using a number of other metrics. And as you correctly indicate with your question, you know, at some point with low interest rates and overall lower available returns, it may not be the appropriate number to continue to apply. But for the time being, as Group CFO, I continue to apply it relatively rigorously. Yep.
I think maybe one thing to add is if you write casualty, that's on a cap basis, but on a PV basis. So you could have a large casualty transactions where in the first year you have to set up reserve relatively high, and then you have to in interest rates coming through for 7 years. So it meets 11% overall, right, on a PV basis, not necessarily the first year.
No, indeed.
Every large transaction, we have a document, and in that document we see the whole EVM view and the whole gap view over time, year on year, and it has to meet this 11% hurdle.
Okay, can I take from your comments that the large transaction with AIG at the start of the year was based on this type of metrics, because I think that there were some comments in the market saying that potentially you may have taken this deal on relatively low profitability levels. So typically the size of the transaction with AIG could pertain to this kind of hurdle rates.
I have to say we're extremely happy with that particular deal, but we look at different metrics, right? We look at it. We don't look at accounting year combined ratio being great every single year. We look at overall on an economic basis, right? EVM and also GAAP, right? How will this accumulate? So what is the, if you want, the PV combined ratio, the present value combined ratio, and that was attractive for that particular deal. So, you know, clients are also in a different capital regime, they have different interests, and I think that's where you get interesting transactions, win-win transactions, is when, you know, two companies have different KPIs, they try to optimize, then and they're in different regimes, right? Then you have interesting opportunities. And so, you know, I'm sure they are very happy with the deal, and we are very happy with the deal, and that's possible.
Okay, sure. Thank you.
The next question is from Philip Kett, Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, everyone. Just one final question from me. On the life and health reinsurance business, there's a comment in the presentation about successful renewals in China and Australia. Is that now a significant portion of the business? Thank you.
So it's not that significant, no, because you have some renewal business also in Europe, by the way, but that's 1-1. It's not a big part of the business. It's not driving it.
Thank you.
As a reminder, if you wish to register for a question, please press star and one on your telephone. Our next question is from Frank Kopfinger, Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, everybody. I have two questions. My first question is on the P&C Re combined ratio. Could you elaborate a little bit there on the underlying trends? And I'm thinking especially about either on your adjusted way, the way from the 95.6 that we had in Q1 to 102% almost now in Q2. But you could also do, you strip everything out, like the reserve releases, nat cats, man-made, and so on. Then you see the hiccup in Q2. And could you walk us through this increase, what the drivers are here? I'm thinking especially on, is it driven by the shift mix, by seasonality, and also by the expenses, if you look on the combined ratio? And then my second question is on your buyback. Now that you've upstreamed 3.5 billion of dividend to the holding, you generated 1.9 billion in profits, have still left over of 850 million of net cut budget. What could derail you really now to the buyback for next year or this year?
Listen, there are all sorts of different scenarios about what could happen in the remainder of the year that may lead us to conclude that there are better uses of capital than the buyback. It could be losses that occur, real losses, so independent of what we have in our budget. Windstorm takes place somewhere in the North America, somewhere in Europe, earthquake somewhere around the world. Could be opportunities that arise to invest capital. So I think I just go back to my earlier comment about the way in which we think about capital and the hierarchy that we think about it. But as we get toward the end of the year, if we find ourselves sitting in a situation where the amount of capital we hold is in excess of that we think we should reasonably hold to continue to be able to respond to opportunities that arise, then we'll think about the best way to return that excess capital to our shareholders. As for your first question, there's really not a whole lot more I can add. There's seasonality, of course. Every individual quarter is a little bit different. Our business mix continues, of course, to evolve a little bit. It's also business that we've written in previous periods, previous renewals now flow their way through our P&L in terms of earned premium and loss expectations. We've walked you through earlier a little bit the way that we think about our large net cat budget and the fact that it's not exactly linear throughout the year. We've provided you with some information about the actual versus expected net cat and the prior year impact. I don't really have a whole lot more to add to that in terms of granularity or insights, other than I would just caution you that the 99% estimate is an estimate for a full year. There are a number of things that can move to change that over the course of the year. We still believe after two quarters that it's an appropriate number. I think the actual adjusted CR, adjusting for the expected versus actual and the prior accident year development, coming in at just under 99, so just shy of the 99% estimate, is at least some indication that the number may not be too far off, but time will tell.
Thanks.
Our next question is a follow-up by Vinit Malhotra. Please go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, thank you for taking a follow-up. I just wanted to just check on this two losses in California that we are talking about today. How does Swiss Re normally look at a loss? I mean, if the loss occurred in 3Q15 or 4Q15, then should it not be the case that it should be reserved to some magnitude back in those quarters? I mean, I just want to understand how this reserving philosophy works, if you don't mind.
No, that's perfectly fair. And the short answer to your question is yes. The specifics of these two losses, however, meant that both the responsibility for the losses, these were not property losses, these were casualty coming through liability. So the determination of responsibility for the loss and also determination of the magnitude of the loss didn't actually take place. It wasn't possible until effectively in Q2. So it wasn't possible at the time that the events actually started or occurred. But in principle, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is one of the things that makes this somewhat unusual. And the fact that we have two of these now in the same quarter is even more unusual. But rest assured, we've looked into this quite closely to see, as Christian indicated, if there's some sort of trend. And the only thing that we can really see is the fact that both of them are in California.
Yeah.
But other than that, completely unrelated to each other. The circumstances just developed in such a way that we didn't have a view of the loss back in the quarter when the event occurred. It only became quite clear to us, specifically also this culpability, the responsibility issue, during the course of Q2 of this year.
All right. Thanks for the time.
Sure.
Our last question is from Victor Gandhi. Sid Dendron, please go ahead.
Hi, it's Vikram Gandhi from SocGen. A couple of questions. One is on the amount of short-term investments and the cash that you hold. If I look at the total of these two elements, the short-term and the cash, it's about $17 billion. Plus, I appreciate it's come down a bit from the last quarter, but it still looks substantial. So any thoughts around how you intend to deploy this cash and translate it into some form of a running investment income would be helpful? And the second is related to the life and health re business. About 3 years ago, you did a cleanup of the book, with particularly with regard to the YRT and PLT. So can you give us some comfort around the PLTs? So let's say a couple of years down the line, you know, the T10s and T15s move into T15s and T20s, we wouldn't have another cleanup exercise going in a year or two. So those are my two questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. So I'll take the first, and then Christian will maybe pick up the second. So you're right. You're looking at slide 29, I suppose, and you can see the cash and short-term investments. We still hold a good the cash position. Nonetheless, we more or less match in terms of overall asset liability matching. We're currently, I think, minus 2.9 million DV01. We have been actually moving some cash into government bonds, as you see. That number has gone up a little bit, as well as in these short-term investments, which are typically also just short-term government paper. But you can imagine not government paper with a negative yield, but government paper that still has a positive yield, albeit those papers are also becoming fewer and far between, and the yields are becoming a little bit less. It remains a little bit of a quagmire. We have no intent to start putting a lot of cash in vaults or cash in mattresses or anything of the sort. We're looking for good quality credit. We want to maintain the overall asset allocation ranges that we've previously indicated. Actually, during the course of Q2, we took a little bit of risk off the table with the equities and alternatives. We continue to look for opportunities to invest in high quality assets, but it's hard for me to say exactly where that cash will go. We're not going to go chasing yield, that's for sure. Continue to hold a good cash position, no doubt, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yes, in terms of PLTs, so this post-level term issue in the U.S. on our old book of business, I think nothing has changed over the last 2 years. So it continues to be a drag. It will be a drag going forward. We have a whole team mitigating it. So that's, I think, what we talked about at the time Investor Day, and that's going quite well. The team, by working together with the client, can mitigate it by having basically more people staying after the PLT period with the client, which is better economically for the client and for ourselves. But they can't mitigate it completely away. I think the relevant thing for all of you and our investors is that we have taken that into account into all of our projections and the 10 to 12% ROE we want to achieve. So it just means we have used the time and continue to use the time to add on more good business and do large transactions where we can, so that we can stay within this 10 to 12%. So if I could, if I was a magician, could get away with that business, I would immediately get rid of it, but it's not possible. And so we just work with it as we do with the whole in-force book.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Philippe Brahin again. So we've come to the end of our Q&A session. Thank you very much, all of you, for joining. And if you have any follow-up questions, please do not hesitate to contact any member of the investor relations team. And Sami will follow up with you on the PNC reserve book, as David mentioned. So thank you again, everyone, for participating today.